right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 35 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We're going to get into the story of ancient Greece today. Really, we're going to just, about all we can manage here at this point is to set the context for the most important series of developments that we're going to be observing. Because, of course, we want to focus on the material that is most present-centrically relevant. That permits us, when it comes to the story of ancient Greece, to focus in particular on Athens. And so that definitely is going to be our primary objective, is to understand the political history of Athens. We will see, however, that, and this is going to be one of those peculiar features of Greek history, is that there, in a way, there is no Greece. Certainly not in the sense that we use the term today. When we speak of Greece today, we are talking about a country. We're talking about a political unity that has been fused together by a single government. And so it's more than just a cultural collection. It is a country. It's a country with its own government. So that's what it is today. But this is one of the things that is a little tricky about ancient Greek history, is that that's not the case. Ancient Greece is, as a culture, it's a collection of localized cultures, of which Athens is one and the most important one, but only one among many. And it is a loosely connected culture that for most of its history exhibits kind of a number of separate parallel stories. So that creates a little bit of the complexity. In a way, it's a little like Mesopotamia, right? Because we have in Mesopotamia, we have Akkad and Sumer, and then we have Babylon, and we have Ur, and all these, and Ashur, the capital of Assyria, and all these various city-states. And but typically they're connected, or one of them is dominant, and then it's an empire over a few hundred years. In Greece, we don't get that. In Greek history, the cities remain separate. And so that's part of the challenge. And luckily we have a good, you know, selection criteria in the form of present centrism to help us slice through all that complexity and focus in on the most important stuff. But even as we are doing that, we need context. Even as we are focusing in primarily on Athens, we need context, we need geography, we need an understanding of kind of a baseline understanding of some of the politics and cultural issues surrounding the story of ancient Athens, especially when we come to that point when Greece does unify in its own peculiar way. It unifies because of the threat of Persia. And so this is classic, you know, politics in history, right? Different peoples, separate peoples who aren't necessarily friends or allies for any other reason, all of a sudden come under pressure from a common enemy and they combine. And this is absolutely critical to the history of mankind. But it's also, we're going to see that sadly, it wasn't something that the Greeks could maintain. And because of that, ultimately, that's why democracy disappears. That's what we have to have, which is a tragedy, which is so sad for all of us, is that democracy only lasts so long, and then it is submerged in a tidal wave of archaism, and it becomes, the culture of ancient Greece becomes assimilated into this vast Roman Empire, which sadly, by the time it is doing that, itself has basically reverted to archaism and has very little to contribute to the story of mankind. So it's kind of a sad story in many regards. I mean, we have to celebrate the positives because they are permanent. They have reached us, and hopefully we'll never forget them. But they do disappear, and it has a lot to do with this strange separateness of Greece. So let's start off with geography, which is especially fun when you have the benefit of satellite maps. So let's take a look at this. It's always fun. So this is helpful. This is Greece and surrounding areas. We can see the boot of Italy over there to the left, which is pretty cool, right? We can see the Black Sea at the top right. And I can post this to the class webpage too, and it's pretty cool. And then I'll also post another one that I'll show you shortly that connects to this one. But this is basically, this is Greece right here, right? Starting at about here, and then this peninsula that sticks down, it's called the Balkan Peninsula, and it sticks down from Europe. And then it also has its own extra little protuberance here, which is called the Peloponnese. And we'll talk about that as well. And then there's a whole bunch of islands here. The biggest one is down here. It's called Crete. And then we have a whole bunch of other smaller islands. And this whole area here is called the Aegean Sea. I'll give you a map that has a bunch of labeled features on it to make sure that you're oriented to the whole thing. But this particular view is kind of useful in a number of regards. One thing is, this white here is revealing. That's not clouds. So this white is clouds. This white is clouds. But all of this other white is not clouds. It's snow. And that tells us kind of something quite interesting. Right, that this terrain here is mountainous, right? And that is one of those geographical features that is so important to Greek history. Because Greece does not have a Nile River. It doesn't have a Tigris or Euphrates. It doesn't have one of those conduits or transportation corridors that would allow, or facilitate anyway, facilitate the unification of the area. It doesn't have that. So that is, you know, is not by itself, you know, going to determine the history of the country, but it's going to be a huge factor in the history of the country for sure. So you don't get a Menes and Armor in Greek history. There never is one. Closest we're going to get later on would be maybe Alexander the Great, but that really doesn't qualify. What we don't get, because there's no Menes and Armor, we don't get is a unifier who brings the culture together in such a way that kind of it emerges into history. We just don't get that. And the terrain has a lot to do with that. Because how are you supposed to unify something like this? I'm going to switch for a moment from satellite view to more of a political map, covering almost the same area here. I've zoomed in a little bit. And here's that mountain range that you could see back there. And you can see rivers kind of peeling off in all directions. Small ones. Much, much smaller than anything that you find in Egypt, like the Nile or the Mesopotamian rivers, Tigris, Euphrates. These are really small. And so you don't get that unified geographical area that one guy could come in and, commanding an army, would understandably be able to fuse that whole area together politically. Right? Because in this area, You would have to. I mean, you only got two choices. If you're going to unify a country like this, one way you would go by land. But to do that, you'd have to be climbing mountains all the time. It would be really, really hard. In history, we have a few rare examples of characters crossing mountains heroically with their armies. It's so rare and so special that usually it represents, you know, somebody who is unbelievably special and really historically significant. Does anybody remember any of those historically significant conquerors? We're going to see one of them later on this year. Who's the famous guy who crosses the Alps? Keen?
Napoleon.
Yeah, right. So he's the one who ends up going to Egypt, and he's also famous for crossing the Alps, which is a tremendous natural barrier. And these escapades, these great accomplishments, are so rare. Nemo, you know another one?
Hannibal.
All right, we're going to talk about Hannibal this year. Yes, he also crossed the Alps. One final one, not quite as famous, it'll ring a bell. Charlemagne. Charlemagne also crossed the Alps, so into Italy, and that led to the unification of Europe temporarily, and he was crowned Emperor of the Romans by the Pope in Rome. So those are the three big names in terms of, you know, great mountain climbing conquerors. We don't have any in Greek history. So there is no Manes and armor. These mountains are going to keep the people separate. They're also going to do something else, right? What's that? Not only does, in that Nilocentric society, for instance, in Egypt, right, it permits political unification, but what's that other thing that these handy-dandy river valleys do for human beings, which, well, the Greeks are not going to get, right? What's that other thing that the rivers do for early civilizations? Theo?
Well, I mean, it provides easy irrigation.
Yeah, it provides an environment that makes agriculture as easy as it can be, I mean, for primitive human beings. So it makes it easier for you to get your start, right? If you got to do a few basic things, which we've enumerated, that amount to climbing up into the Archaic Plateau, if those are the things you need to do, it sure is nice if Mother Nature gives you the perfect place to do it. And Greece is certainly not that. So it is one difficult place to start out. I mean, the climate is still relatively good because it's the Mediterranean Sea. That is a quite, you know, temperate area. So that's pretty good. But there is no river that's going to provide so much of that nice, smooth, cyclical kind of pattern that you need in order to have an easygoing kind of agricultural lifestyle. You don't get that. So instead, you have these small communities. I mean, and one thing that you can't get right from not having a big river like that is, since you can't grow as much food in any particular area, you don't get as many people either. So Greece is not a very large or populous area in the ancient world. It's typically, its history is characterized by pockets of civilization which are only loosely connected to each other. And primarily, the other feature that you can see here is the sea, right? I mean, the islands of Greece, the peninsulas of Greece, you know, by definition, they are surrounded by water. And so this leads to a seagoing culture, a culture that has a lot of sailing as a part of its traditions. You can see that most of these cities that are labeled on here, which are the primary historical cultures, they're located next to the sea. They're never very far from the sea. And that's because the land doesn't do too much for you. You've got to turn to the sea. I mean, it's another tremendous resource if you know how to make use of it. It's also a way to come into contact with other people and trade with them and get values from them as well. And so a lot of Greek history relates to the fact that it's the sea is so important to the Greeks. And one of those things is that, you know, we see Greek, main part of Greece over here, but also to the east, we have a number of what are called colonies and societies that arise and become fairly independent. There's a lot of colonization in Greek history. The Greeks move out to new locations in order to be able to expand their population because there's only so much they can do in their home region. And in fact, what we'll see is the Greeks had colonies as far afield as Italy and France and all the way around the Black Sea and over here in what we call Turkey today. And they did come into contact with the other cultures of the Mediterranean necessarily, right? By planting colonies in various places. And this partly brings them into collision with the Persian Empire, which stretched all the way to here as well, right? We saw that the Persian Empire conquered Lydia, which is labeled here on the right-hand side of our map, and that's what brought the Greeks into contact with the Persians. Oops, sorry, I wanted to stay mostly zoomed in there so it's easier to read. All right, so because of this isolation of the separate communities in Greece, we're going to get a peculiar feature in terms of the political history of Greece. We're going to see separate cities operating as countries. We're not, like I said, we're not going to see the unification. We're going to see instead cities that behave like countries, which is a pretty cool little concept, and it's very rare today. It's not entirely, there are city-states today. This is the term for it. A city, the term is a hyphenated term. And I'll just chat it for you. So you can take it down if you like. So Athens and others in Greece are what we would call city-states, which is to say, there are cities that behave like countries. There are cities that are basically their own sovereign state with their own government and completely independent government and their own army. So that's a little bit, that's one thing from a modern perspective that's a little bit hard to grasp in a way about these ancient cultures, that they could be so small and so isolated and fragmented. But that was what Greece was like. It's going to end up being their greatest weakness in the end, but in the beginning, it's in a way, it's a strength. In a way, because it creates this variety, it creates this unusual environment where you have multiple competing cultures in close proximity, and I don't know, it's hard to say. Was it better or worse in some sense? Would it have been better for them to unite, or would they even have been able to emerge as this remarkable culture that they were if they had unified? So maybe there, you know, there's a just one of those peculiar things that happens in history. There's some good and some bad, and they come together, and you got to accept that. It's kind of such a neat situation. So they're all these separate city-states, separate kind of fragments of Greek culture. They're connected, but it makes for a pretty, what's the right word? Choppy. Let's use that word. It's pretty choppy early history. It's not a continuous and smooth narrative. A little bit more like Mesopotamia, in the sense that you get one of these will pop up and be in charge for a while, and then it'll just disappear. And the next one will come, and it'll take over, and then it disappears, and then and so on and so forth. So it's really quite a succession of relatively dominant powers But they come and they go, and they come and they go, and eventually the whole thing just gets swept within the Roman Empire. So where does it all start? This city, the story of all of these separate cities. The first part of Greek history, the first fragmented kind of culture that, or fragment of culture that emerges is down here. The island of Crete. And we see this capital city called Knossos. And the people who lived there were called the Minoans. And we know that the Minoans were contemporary with the Mesopotamians and the Egyptians. We know because of archaeology primarily. Because archaeology has revealed the presence of Minoan artifacts, you know, dating back beyond 2000 BC. Has revealed the presence of Minoan artifacts in Egypt and Mesopotamia, and artifacts from those cultures in Crete. So we know. We know they traded with each other. We know they had contact. We know that they were around at the same time. But evidently this is a smaller place, not going to have kind of the same historical footprint as any of those other kind of major kingdoms. And it doesn't last long in terms of it kind of pops up on our historical radar and then it goes away. And the reason is we can't read the writing of the Minoans. The writing of the Minoans is called Linear A. It's a technical, obviously technical description of the writing of the Minoans. And I don't know if we quickly go to Wikipedia, whether or not we can see what Minoan Linear A looks like. Do I have a Wikipedia link here? Let's just go Wikipedia. Let's see, Linear A. Undeciphered writing system of the Minoan civilization. So there are some of the symbols. I don't know if that how accurate that is. Looks more like Chinese to me. Anyway, so that's Linear A. So we don't know their story. And they were conquered by the successive people called the Mycenaeans. So the Minoans come and go. They're Greeks, but we don't know much about them. And then they're conquered by people called the Mycenaeans. Difficult to spell. I'll probably get it wrong at least once. And let me show you where the Mycenaeans are on the map. Oops, I wanted to zoom more. So here is Mycenae. I'm gonna post this to the class webpage so that you can have it and look at it. There's Mycenae right there. The ones that are labeled in blue, I did that on purpose. They're the ones from the prehistorical times. So that's Mycenae. And they show up. And the reason why they're worth mentioning is the Mycenaeans did something that became pretty famous. The Mycenaeans sailed across to this place and sacked it. Oopsie, I meant to put a box around that. There. So you guys have probably heard of this by now. I'd be really surprised if you haven't. Right? But if you haven't, then I'm not going to give you any spoilers about it. But the famous story of the most famous story pertaining to the Mycenaeans is called the Trojan War. And it's a fantastic story. And there have been modern movies made of it as well, which I like, actually, which is pretty rare. There actually is a movie called Troy, with Brad Pitt, which I actually like. So if you want to see a modern version of a movie pertaining to the Mycenaeans and the story of Troy, then go ahead. It's pretty violent and it's pretty graphic and everything, but I think you guys are old enough to watch it. So it's an amazing story, and you've probably heard of the expression the Trojan horse. And if you haven't and you don't know what the story of the Trojan horse is, then go read the story of the Trojan War somehow. And there's some children's versions of it that are pretty good, apparently. I'm not too familiar with them. But the story of the Trojan War and episodes of Mycenaean history, which we don't know very clearly, were not really well historically known to the Greeks themselves either, because the Mycenaeans were also conquered and basically disappeared from history. So we have some evidence of them. It's not quite as exciting as some of what we have for ancient Egypt. The king, Agamemnon, we do have a death mask for him. So it's gold. It's kind of interesting to compare that. Here we go, it's kind of side by side almost. There's Agamemnon's death mask. There's King Tut's death mask. You can see that the Mycenaeans didn't quite have the same artistic skills and workmanship, but anyway, it's gold, so it's pretty cool. So that's Agamemnon's death mask, and we don't know much more about them. They disappeared from history, and the story of the Mycenaeans was told, excuse me while I sort this out, in ancient Greece. Oh, I lost it. Okay, I'm going to bring it back up. Excuse me for my messy screen work here while I bring it back up. Here we are. By kind of bards or epic storytellers, the most famous of which was a man named Homer. And he wrote two stories. One was called the Iliad, and the other one was known, it's called the Odyssey. So even this is not classical Greece yet, Nemo. Even this is not classical Greece yet. So we're still, in fact, we haven't even quite emerged into the archaic period of Greece yet. That's the thing, is that it takes a lot longer for the Greeks to really show up and to have this really permanent presence in history. Here they are, the Greeks that we're looking at here, they're still the archaic Greeks. They're still, the guy with the lyre there, that's Homer, and he's telling his story, and of course people are collected, they stop their farming, and they're sitting around and they're listening to the great story about their ancestors, their heroic ancestors that fought in the Trojan War and so on. And this is their entertainment, you know, this is what it was like in primitive times. And yeah, we've done this painting in History Through Art in the past. I do like this painting too. This was how the Greeks connected to their ancient past. They didn't have a record, and the Mycenaeans had a language similar to Linear A. It's called Linear B, and I'm not sure what the state of the art is in terms of the decipherment of Linear B. I think there's some knowledge of what Linear B was, but there's not a lot of documents to work with. So we still don't know the history. And it takes a while for the Greeks to get to the point where they're acting on a kind of concerted scale, a collective scale that allows for us to piece together their history. And so when does that happen? How does that happen? Well, after the Mycenaeans, there's an episode in Greek history known as the Dorian Invasion. So this is to Greek history, kind of like what the Gutti period is to Mesopotamian history, or the Hyksos are to the Egyptians. It's another wave of disruption, but it creates a kind of permanent split in Greek civilization just before the, well, not just before, but in the centuries leading up to the time of Homer. So Mycenaean civilization collapses, and you have different parts of Greece that fall to the Dorians. They seem to be Greek. We don't know enough. We don't have a clear picture. They're Greeks, but maybe from the north or some other part, we don't know. They're more barbaric. They're not quite the civilized Greeks that are the most admirable. So we get these Dorian characters, and they are the ones that populate, colonize, and form up this important city-state of Sparta. So the Dorians become associated with Sparta and some of these and other related city-states. So in Greek history, when we get to Greek history, we have kind of the Dorians in Sparta, and then we have another major group of Greeks called the Ionians, and they are in Athens and other places. These are kind of the two dominant city-states, and we're going to see that part of the reason why they could never get along was because of this Dorian invasion, because of this history of their antagonism, because of this dark period whereby the Dorians disrupted Greek culture and Mycenaean culture collapsed and so on. They were pretty much constant enemies. So the Dorians and the Ionians, it's like France versus England, right? It's like something along those lines. A pretty permanent, these are people that are related, and they have a common history and they have things in common, but they really don't like each other, and they're pretty much always at each other's throats. Except they're all Greeks, and there was something about that they all embraced. So they didn't like each other. They were separate from each other and quite isolated from each other, and had at various points in their history fought each other, but they still somehow felt connected to one another. And they spoke the same language. So what were some of those connections? They did speak pretty much the same language, and they did have some common religious beliefs and some common heroic mythology that linked them together. And for many city-states, it had something to do with the Trojan War. There were other heroic ancestors that they look back to. So the Spartans, for instance, considered themselves descendants of Heracles. The Athenians considered themselves the descendants of the hero Theseus. And there's a lot of fun to be had there if you want to study some of these myths and the various characters that are at the root of these various cultures. They're a lot of fun. But ultimately, they did come together and did feel this unity. And that's where the history starts. So they were city-states and they were separate, but the first event that we can pinpoint pretty well in Greek history has to do with the unity of Greek culture and the common denominators between these different city-states. And it was a religious festival, combined religious and athletic festival, that was held at Olympia. Right here. And I don't think it's any mystery to anybody here what that was called. It's one of those other present-centric things about ancient Greece. Not quite on the same scale as democracy, but nonetheless, every 4 years, we have the modern Olympics, and they are modeled after the ancient Olympics. The Olympic Games of the Greeks were this religious, cultural, athletic festival that they held to celebrate their common culture. There was a temple to Zeus at Olympia, and that was certainly the main god within the pantheon of Greek gods. And every 4 years, they would come together and they would celebrate these festivals together. And it was a very significant symbol of their cultural unity. Whenever there was an Olympic Games, no matter what was going on, there was what was called a sacred truce. So if any two city-states were at war, they would stop fighting. And so that was called a sacred truce, which is a pretty powerful expression, right? Because it gives you that sense of the religious motive and the, you know, how important it was to them. So they would have a sacred truce and they would hold the Olympic Games. And it was a time of peace. It was a time of celebrating their common culture. And the first Olympic Games were held in, which is a good anchor fact and a good, convenient, easy mnemonic date for history. The first Olympic Games were held in 776 BC. So that's where we're going to start the story. Don't have a clear picture before that, but there's a lot of documentation having to do with the ancient Greeks. I'm going to use this vase as our symbol of the Olympic Games. You got these sprinters, and it's a beautiful piece of artisans kind of craft work. And so I'm going to use that as a symbol. And, you know, it's a good mnemonic, like Theo is saying. It's, you got to be careful about the math there, Theo, because it's 1776 plus 776, so it doesn't work out to 2000. But it is pretty much the same kind of, you know, same date, so very memorable, very easy. I mean, I don't know, I never forgot the date whenever I learned it, because it's like 1776 AD, 776 BC is just really easy to remember somehow, right? Because it's so similar. So we're going to use that as our first anchor fact of Greek history. It's the closest thing that we have in Greece to a Menes Narmer type of thing, because there's not going to be a unity politically speaking, but there is a unity culturally. And that says a lot when it comes to Greece. Because the fact that they could never unify politically was part of the reason why there was such an interesting variety of things that happened in Greece, and some of the best things that happened. It's also ultimately the reason why Greece collapsed and democracy disappeared. So it's a good thing and a bad thing. It just is what it is. All right, so the story begins in 776, and we'll take it from there. When we come back, we're going to have a fairly long break here. I mean, tomorrow is History Through Art, and then we have a Thanksgiving break. So that will be nice. And but when we get back, we're going to trace the archaic political history of Athens. We're going to see what it was like for the Athenians. They had a monarchy. All of these city-states had monarchies. So that was similar. That was pretty much the same as every other place. But maybe one of the reasons why things went differently was because it was so localized. Because people were so closely connected to each other within their city-states, it maybe gave an opportunity to the Greeks to experiment in other ways. And they started to depart from monarchy pretty early in their recorded history. The Athenians, anyway. So we'll get to that story and we'll see them slowly evolving in the direction of democracy for which they are famous. Okay, but that at least gives us the setting, the context. And so now we're ready to dive into the particular story. All right, so that's going to do it. Yeah, that's good enough. Tomorrow's history through art. Okay. Thoughts, questions, comments? Alrighty, folks. Oh, wait, Keen, perhaps? Go ahead.
I don't know if I'm just having a good day or whether even the early Greek history is awesome, but I'm already feeling like Greek history is going to be great and we've barely even started.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, it's cool. You can feel the difference already, right? I mean, it just doesn't start the same way. It doesn't have the same character. Hopefully there's a little energy there, anticipation. Yeah, I think it's a lot of, I mean, it's a lot of fun. And so, yeah, it's going to be different. We're going to see right away the Greeks inventing stuff that just nobody else thought of. And so it's fun. It's definitely fun. Glad you're looking forward to it. All right. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye-bye.
Bye.